This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his New Testament History, Literature, and Theology course taught at Gordon College in the spring of 2012. This is lecture number 2 on Alexander, Hellenism, and the Hasmoneans down to the time of Herod the Great.
All right, welcome back. We've been discussing so far the Persian Empire and the transition from Babylon, actually Assyria, destruction of Nineveh in 612, Babylon taking over in 586, destroying the temple, Nebuchadnezzar, Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, and Ezekiel, then down 70 years, and then the Persians under Cyrus. And we've been working through the Persian Empire. We talked about Cyrus the Great, the founder of the Persian Empire, a great man called the Messiah in the Old Testament and other things. Cyrus was the founder of the empire, the warrior who began it. We talked about Cambyses, his son, was kind of a nobody, went down into Egypt. Darius was the organizer, created the Beestone inscription, side of the mountain. And Darius is the guy who finished the second temple in 515. And then you had Xerxes, who was married to Esther, Artaxerxes, who was Nehemiah was his cupbearer. And then you've got the filtering off of the Persian Empire, the waning days of the Persian Empire as various people take over, but they're nothing, the torch is gone. And then finally, down to Darius III, and this is around 334, 333 BC, dukes it out with Alexander the Great, and this is when Alexander takes over. And so we're going to focus now on this shift from the Persian Empire, which notice is from the east, and now the Greeks are going to come from the west. And this is going to be where this massive transition of culture takes place from east to west. Israel being east kind of thing. Now it's going to be switching over to Greece. Alexander is going to be the one who does that. So let's ask some initial questions here on Hellenism. Hellenism means Greek culture, Hellenism. And how did Alexander conquer the world in 10 years? How did he do it? It's pretty impressive. Young man that he was, he died about 32, 33, I think. Conquered the world. Must have started when he was about 23 years old. Conquered the world. What happened to Alexander's empire? After he conquers the world in 10 years, he dies. What happens then as a young man? What happens? He's kind of unprepared for that, and his empire fragments. And we're going to see into five sections that are very important for Israel's history later on. Why is the New Testament written in Greek instead of in Hebrew? What was the relationship between Alexander and the Greek language? We want to talk about that and how Alexander is going to spread the Greek language over the whole world at that point. And then how did the Jews get from Alexander to Roman rule? Alexander is going to come in about 333 BC, but in the time of Jesus, you're going to see that it's all Roman rule. So how did the shift from Greek to Roman happen? And how did that shift take place between Greece being the dominant power and universal empire and Rome? So that's what we'll be talking about next. And then as we do in the transition, there will be these people called the Maccabees. And the Maccabees, many of you have read in this class, I require reading a big section out of the first Maccabees. And so the Maccabees boys, we'll learn how the Maccabees play. We realize the Maccabees, the book of Maccabees, first, second Maccabees are in the Apocrypha, and they take place right narrating a history right around 165 BC. So Alexander's 333, about halfway down, the Maccabees are going to come in, and they're going to be Jews who are going to fight with the Syrians at that time. So we want to look at the Maccabees and gain some of that. The Maccabees will actually play some role coming into the New Testament. All right, just a kind of a review here. This is our Persian Empire, and you see all the way from the Indus River coming across Pakistan, Afghanistan. Here's Persia proper, down into Mesopotamia where Iraq is today, Turkey, Israel, and Egypt, all under the domination, the hegemony of the Persian Empire. Greece is standing by itself, and now Greece is going to fight back Athens here. Alexander is actually from up here in Macedonia. So Alexander first is going to have to come down here and unite Greece, because the Athenians and the Spartans right here were fighting with each other all the time. So Alexander, actually his father, Philip of Macedon, is going to help with some of this. Anyways, Philip of Macedon and Alexander got to unite basically Greece before they can go after the Persians. Okay? So that's going to be kind of what happens next. And here's Greece, here's Athens, Corinth, right in the isthmus, and Sparta. those three, really important. Corinth for the book of Corinthians, Athens, Paul will speak there, Sparta, the warriors, and Macedonia, up in the top, Philip of Macedonia. Philip is Alexander's father. And so they'll name a place. Philippi is actually named after Alexander's father, Philip, in Macedonia, Thessaloniki and Berea up there. So Alexander is going to basically unite Greece here, and then he's going to go over, he's going to cross over to and actually defeat the Persians here and go to Troy. By the way, there's where Troy is, right there up in Persia, or up in Turkey, excuse me. Right there is Troy, the Iliad and the Odyssey, those kinds of things. Okay, let's talk about Alexander. First, before we talk about Alexander, we need to talk about Philip of Macedon. Philip of Macedon was Alexander's father. Philip was a military genius. He developed a fighting machine that Alexander is going to ride. Alexander is his son. I don't want to take anything away from Alexander. Alexander was brilliant in his moves and things. But Philip of Macedon trained his son to be a warrior. And what happened is Philip of Macedon put this army that was unique in the ancient world. It could fight all year round. Okay, usually in the ancient world, even from 2 Samuel chapter 11 with David, you get this thing that the kings went off to war in the spring. Because the spring, there was times you could harvest wheat and barley so your guys wouldn't starve. So you always went to war during harvest time. So you could just rip off food from the people as you're going and you didn't need supplies. Philip of Macedon figured out a way of supplying his troops all year round so that his troops, Philip of Macedon's troops, could fight all year round rather than just in the spring and the fall. So Philip of Macedon builds the fighting machine that he's going to hand off to his son. Philip of Macedon also wanted his son educated in the best manner possible. And so Philip of Macedon had Aristotle come up and teach his son, Alexander. Alexander studied under Aristotle. Aristotle studied under whom? Do you remember that? Aristotle studied under Plato. Plato studied under Socrates. So you have Socrates, the kind of the old wise man. Stories, there's all sorts of questions with this stuff. But Socrates going to Plato. Plato going to Aristotle. And Aristotle, the master of logic and Aristotelian logic and ethics. Nicomachean ethics. Aristotle then teaches Alexander. So Alexander is trained as a warrior. He's also trained as a scholar. And Alexander then is going to be able to put those two things together and conquer the whole world in about 10, 12 years. So it's pretty impressive. So Philip of Macedon is assassinated in about 336. Philip of Macedon is assassinated, unfortunately. Alexander, his background with Aristotle, as we said before, was a really good thing for him, being educated then. He crosses over into Turkey at the Granicus River. Not important, but basically, and defeats the Persians up by Troy. And so he comes across the northern part down into Turkey and defeats the Persians in 334, his first big victory there at the Granicus River. What's interesting to me is that after he defeats the Persians, he doesn't chase after them. He actually says, hey, I'm over here and Troy is just right over here, and he's never been to Troy. And so Alexander goes over and visits Troy, the Iliad and the Odyssey and all that kind of stuff, Achilles and things. He pays honor to Troy. And so Alexander takes time out, goes over and visits Troy. And rather than chasing after the Persians directly, he also is brilliant in that he takes all the cities along the coast of Asia Minor or Turkey. He goes down the coastline and takes all the coastal cities. That way the Persians can't send boats to cut off his supply lines. Very brilliant move. Alexander takes the coastal towns. The Persians can't cut off his supply lines then, and he's able to keep the straw of supplies coming to his troops because of the way, rather than pursuing the Persians exactly. He comes over to Issus. Issus is kind of right where Turkey meets with Syria, right at the corner of the Mediterranean, the northeastern corner. He defeats the Persians again at Issus in 333, and this is where I pull the date from Alexander, 333, this victory at Issus. Now, as he's over by Turkey in the corner there, what he does first, he doesn't just chase after the Persians back over to Persia, Iran, and Iraq, and that. What he does is he goes down into Egypt first. And why is that smart? He doesn't want the Persians to be able to sneak around his back and take his back out. so he's got to cover his back. So what he does is he goes down to Egypt first before he goes after the Persians over in Mesopotamia. So he defeats them in Issus and then goes down, heads down south. As he's going down south, he comes down through Lebanon, and where Syria and Lebanon are, just north of Israel, and he comes to the city of Tyre. Now, the city of Tyre had had some prophecies in Ezekiel chapter 26. The prophet Ezekiel had said that Tyre would be made flat as a pancake. The city of Tyre would be flattened, and the fishermen would spread their nets there. It would be so flat. Well, now you ask, in the ancient world, when a king destroys a city, usually they torch the city, they burn it down, and they kill the people. And the city is left in ruins. A king is not going to take the time and effort to flatten the city. So usually the cities are torched, they're burned, the people are killed, and the king moves on, and you have all these ruins sitting for, you know, sometimes hundreds of years, the ruins remain. That isn't what happened here. This is very unique. Alexander came down to Tyre. The people of Tyre said, Alexander, we're not going to submit to you. Who are you, Alexander? And they said, hey, we got this island out in the Mediterranean Sea, Alexander. And they went out to the island and they say, hey, Alexander, you can't get us. We're out here in the ocean. You don't have any boats. And they had a few boats, but not. You can't get us out here. And so therefore, Alexander's on the coast saying, wait a minute, I got to take this city. These people are offending me. And so he basically said, okay, they've got the city of Tyre that was on the coastland, and Alexander then takes the stones from the city and throws them into the ocean. Takes more stones, throws them in the ocean, and he makes a causeway out to the island, fills in the ocean, goes out to that island, and where does he get the stones for making that causeway? He gets it from the city of what was formerly called Tyre. He flattens the city, just like the Bible said, it would be flat as a fisherman. He takes the stones of the city, throws them into the ocean, and gets out to that island. And to this day, if you go to Google Maps and you go into Lebanon, just north of Israel, maybe 30, 40 miles, you'll notice there's a little like zit or a pimple sticking out into the Mediterranean Sea. That's Tyre, and that's the causeway that Alexander built back then out to that island, and you can see it just kind of sticks out into the Mediterranean Sea. You can see it on Google Maps even till this day. It remains there. So Alexander, by the way, you wouldn't want to be out on that island. When Alexander gets out there, it's like these people, you wouldn't want to be in their shoes. But anyways, Alexander takes Tyre, but it took Alexander, was a 6 or 8 months. 6 or 8 months. Out of 10 years, he's going to conquer the whole world. He spent 6 or 8 months taking Tyre, just that one place. And actually, in doing so, fulfilling the scripture in some sense, there's in the Tyre prophecy in Ezekiel, it's a multiple fulfillment thing you got to work with, many times. Things happened and it was layered. It was layered and it's more complex than when I'm making it out. I realize that. But Alexander had a big part in flattening that city and stuff. Now, by the way, is Alexander going to get along with the Jews? Yeah, the Jews run out and say, hey, Alexander, look at that. You took down Tyre just like our Bible says. Ezekiel said it would be flattened. You flattened it. And Alexander says, hey, the Jews are pretty good people. And so Alexander didn't mess with the Jews. He just went shoop down to Egypt. The Jews were mostly up in the mountains. He didn't have to worry about them. And so he goes down into Egypt. When he goes down to Egypt, he gets to a place called Siwa, and this is the place, remember, Cambyses had trouble with. And what this happens here is people begin to say that when he got to Egypt, see, in Egypt, the Pharaoh was considered a god. In Egypt, the Pharaoh was considered a god, that the Pharaoh was a god or the son of a god, whereas in Mesopotamia, the king was a representative of the god. And so there was two different structures. Alexander gets in Egypt. Hey, the king is a god. And so he starts getting this, his head starts getting bigger at this point. The Siwa place, some people think that's where he got the first idea that he was divine. Something like that. He then takes Egypt. He goes back then. He's got to go back out of Egypt, cross Israel, up through Syria. And he goes over and takes Babylon. Now when he takes Babylon, he ends up marrying this woman called Roxanne. Now, this is important because he's Greek, but yet he's marrying a Mesopotamian woman. Alexander is getting one of the first people to have this notion of globalization. And so what he does is he makes an Opsis, what's called an Opsis banquet. And in this Opsis banquet, basically he invites people from all the different countries that he had dominated. He invites them to this banquet, and kind of this universal banquet, this diverse, culturally diverse banquet where all these people come from all these different countries to eat in Alexander's presence and stuff. And so this is the notion, actually very early, of this notion of conquering the whole world. Globalization starts Alexander's doing this and things. But what's the problem? He's telling his troops, hey, we've been away from home. His troops are saying, we've been away from home for 8-10 years now. Man, we're getting tired of this, Alexander. And Alexander says, hey, don't think about going back to Greece. Intermarry with the people here. Well, the Greeks don't want to hear that. These guys say, I got a wife and kids at home. I don't want to intermarry with anybody here. And so Alexander says, no, intermarry and stuff. So his troops start getting a little bit antsy and things because of the intermarriage. And frankly, Alexander is drunk quite a bit. That's why I call him Alexander the Grape, because he ends up drinking a lot and things, and he's drunk and things. His troops are, again, his troops losing respect for Alexander in some senses, just because he's not, he's doing this intercultural thing rather than saying Greek is the best kind of role. So things start going down. He takes all the way over to the Hindu Kush Mountains, and basically over through Afghanistan, over in Pakistan, Alexander takes that whole area. Now, my son tells me that he takes Afghanistan, but the Afghanis say, no, no one's ever conquered us. That actually, the rumor has it that how he took the Afghans was he married one of the Afghans' princesses, and so therefore they didn't fight. They kind of formed this alliance rather than being conquered by Alexander. So I don't know. I've got to research that more in terms of the historicity of that, but that's at least the Afghani side of thing. Alexander didn't conquer them. He intermarried with them. And so that's interesting as well. But nevertheless, Alexander did dominate that whole area all the way over to the Indus River and basically the Persian Empire. So 10 years, Alexander takes the whole bailiwick. Now, there's these cultural amalgamations now. You've got Greek culture, you've got Egyptian culture, you've got Mesopotamian culture, you've got Aryan culture in Iran and beyond to the Afghanistan and things. And so there's this this movement beyond the Greek polis. The Greek polis, polis means city, like metropolis. Polis means city. And the Greeks were city-states. They were city-states. And basically, you've got movement now beyond the city-state to this whole, like, universal empire. And Alexander is putting this together, this notion of globalization, where Greek language could be spoken in Athens, and you could speak the Greek language over in Babylon, and you could speak the Greek language down in Egypt. And therefore, the whole world began to speak the Greek language and be aware of Greek culture and that kind of thing. This then becomes very important for the New Testament, is the language. And with the language, oftentimes comes a worldview, a way of looking at the world through the language that one speaks. And so what you have is this switch then from an Eastern Semitic Hebrew and Aramaic language over to a Western Hellenistic, what's called Koine Greek. Let me just go off on that a little bit. I've had the privilege of teaching Greek here at Gordon College for a decade now, and over a decade, and Koine Greek. What you had in Greece before Alexander was a dialectical Greek. Okay, so you had Attic Greek in Athens, you had Sparta, different. Each city-state had their own little dialect of Greek. Each city-state had their own little dialect of Greek. Now the problem with that is when you want to found an army of troops, you need to speak the same language. The people in your army need to speak the same language. So when you go out to war, you're on the same page. So what Alexander did was he combined the Greek language. He was from up in Macedonia. He combined the language into what's called Koine Greek. In about 300 BC, Koine Greek comes into vogue. From about 300 BC to about 300 AD, what's right in the middle of that? The New Testament. From about 300 BC to about 300 AD, Koine Greek. Now, what is Koine Greek? Koine simply means common. And what happens was Alexander breaks them out of these city-state dialects and he makes a universal Greek, a common Greek, so that his troops can speak. And so basically this common Greek is very interesting. Scholars, even up into the 19th century, into the 1880s, 1890s, didn't know what Koine Greek was. Some people thought the New Testament was written in a what they called a Holy Spirit Greek. They didn't know what kind of Greek it was. And then all of a sudden in around the 1880s, 1890s, they started finding these papyrus. And the papyrus was written in the same language that the New Testament was written in. And what they discovered was the New Testament was written in the common, what I call street language, the common Greek. It wasn't written in classical high Greek. It was written in the common language of the people. And that's a big thing for me, is to say, what language does God speak? God always speaks the same language. God speaks the language of the people. God speaks the language of the people. When his people spoke Hebrew, how did God communicate with them? He communicated in Hebrew. When they switched to Aramaic, he switches to Aramaic. By the way, will Jesus speak Aramaic probably as his native language? Jesus will say, Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani. Okay? Eloi, Eloi, my God, why have you forsaken me? Talitha kum, little girl, get up. Jesus will have many phrases, you'll catch these phrases of Jesus speaking Aramaic to the people of his day. So Jesus spoke Aramaic, probably his native tongue. He also probably spoke Greek and possibly some other languages as well. Many of the people in that culture are multilingual, largely because Israel is the land between, and therefore you're going to have a lot of commerce and trade. Whenever you have commerce and trade, people learn 4 and 5 different languages. And so Jesus, Greek, Aramaic, possibly Latin, and some other regional area dialects. So Koine Greek then takes over. The New Testament then will be written in the language of the people. I always ask people, what is the language of people today? And it seems to me the language of today, that if God were going to speak in the language today, it's digital. The alphabet now is not 26 letters. The alphabet is 1 and 0. The digital medium, digital 1 and 0, allows you to speak in what? Text. The 1 and 0 allow you to speak in what? Images. You can make pictures and things, and you guys make pictures and Photoshop them and various things. It's all because of the 1 and 0, the new alphabet, the digital alphabet. You can make out of that same 1 and 0, you can make sound. And so many of you listen to MP3s on your iPods or whatever. And so basically the 1 and 0 allows you to express sound. The 1 and 0 also allows you to commit. We're doing right now with this video that you're watching right now is all 1s and 0s, that same digital medium. And so for me, it seems, how would God communicate today? Use the digital medium. Use the language of the people to communicate the word of God today. And so as God used Greek back then, Koine Greek, common Greek, so it seems to me Christians today should use a digital medium for the glory of God and the good of others to communicate the word of God in the digital medium. And that's for one reason why, for example, if you're in this class, you know that I did the work on the DASV, the Digital American Standard Version, and put that whole thing together, the Digital American Standard Version, largely because of the digital allows it to be online and in so many different contexts, phones, tablets, computers, stuff. So anyways, just the language of the people, Koine Greek, switched over to Greek, that's going to have a major impact then. Now, Alexander dies. He dies as a young man. His child is too young. They do some stuff with his wife and stuff, but basically his generals take over. The kid's too young. I mean, Alexander was only, 32, 33. So what's going to happen is we've got 4 generals, and then there's going to be like a fifth guy who comes in here. So there's like four, and then fifth will come in. And kind of this is narrated, actually, very interestingly, in Daniel chapter 11. There's a prediction of this very thing, kind of thing happening. There's this movement from the polis, from the city, to the oikomene, to civilized world. This movement from a very provincial polis city to this oikomene, the whole civilized world in this movement. Cassander was one of his generals who get Macedonia. That's back in Greece. That's no big deal. He dies out and stuff. We're not really worried about that. Thrace, also backed by Macedonia, Lysimachus. So we're going to be working through this CLAPS. It's going to be our acrostic, C-L-A-P-S. And so here's your C-L. Both these guys, not important for us in the New Testament period. Things. This guy is important, Antigonus. Notice he gets Syria and Mesopotamia. So he gets Syria, Mesopotamia, and I believe he also got Turkey. So he got Turkey, Syria, Mesopotamia. Antigonus gets this huge territory all the way from Turkey all the way over to Mesopotamia and beyond. And so this Antigonus gets the biggest piece of the pie. Now, whenever generals get the biggest piece of the pie, are the other generals going to be jealous? And that's what's going to happen. And so who gets Egypt? Egypt, the breadbasket. guy named Ptolemy. Ptolemy gets it, son of Lagi, gets Egypt. So Ptolemy will be over Egypt for numbers and numbers of decades. I often tell people, I'm going to teach you Egyptian history. I'm going to teach you the Ptolemaic period. I want you to memorize all the Ptolemaic rulers of the Ptolemaic Egypt. Here's how it goes. Ptolemy 1, Ptolemy 2, Ptolemy 3, Ptolemy 4. Goes down to Ptolemy, I think it's like 24 or something like that. 24 Ptolemies straight in a row. And so anyways, that's the history of Egypt at this point with the Ptolemies. I've got a friend, Dave Mathewson, who's a phenomenal New Testament scholar, and Dave says Ptolemy, Ptolemy. He pronounces the P. I do it more like pneumonia, where the P goes silent, so I'd say Ptolemy. So I've heard it said both ways. Some people say Ptolemy, other people say just Ptolemy. I'm one of the Ptolemy guys, because I'm basically can't get my mouth spitting like that, Ptolemy. But anyways, so Ptolemy's going to take over Egypt. So Ptolemy's going to be in Egypt. This guy's going to be in Syria. And Israel is right between then, Antigonus and Ptolemy. Now what Ptolemy is going to do is he's going to say Antigonus has got too big a piece, and so Ptolemy is going to commission one of his generals named Seleucus, and Seleucus is going to go up and attack Antigonus. So Ptolemy's general Seleucus is going to go up, and he's under Ptolemy. He's going to send him up there to take out Antigonus, and Seleucus is basically going to go up and take Syria from Antigonus. So now what you have is Seleucus in Syria and Ptolemy in Egypt. And what's in the middle? Between Syria and Egypt, what's in the middle? As it is today, Egypt down south, Syria in the north, Israel's in the middle. So Seleucus and Ptolemy, those two guys are going to be going back and forth in Israel, Seleucus and Ptolemy. For the next 100 years, this is after 300 down to about 200, from about 300 to about 200, the Ptolemies are going to rule Israel. So from 300 to 200, the Ptolemies out of Egypt are going to rule Israel. And largely, the Ptolemies are going to be tolerant. And largely, the Ptolemies will be tolerant. They'll be kind to the Jews. They'll actually support the Jews in some ways. So the Ptolemaic period is basically 323 to 198, basically 300 to 200, 100-year period, the Ptolemies. And they're going to be tolerant toward the Jews, and that's a good thing. They're going to rule over Egypt, and they're going to rule over Palestine. And so the Ptolemies will have control over Palestine for about 100 years here. Ptolemy will take the king, the title is king. So he moves from general, and at 304 he takes the title of king. That's not really important for us. But Alexandria gets built. The city of Alexandria on the coast up in the Delta area there, a little bit to the west, will be built about 200 BC. Alexandria will be a center of learning. And Alexandria will be one of the great centers of learning. When you think of different areas of countries, each area is kind of like known for things. If I were to say to you, and you're an American, I'd say politics, what city comes up when you say politics? Washington, D.C., unfortunately. Politics in Washington, D.C. If I said to you stock trading, what city comes to mind? New York City. If I said to you high tech, what place comes to mind? Well, Silicon Valley on the West Coast. Silicon Valley, Adobe, Apple, all those places out in Silicon Valley, Google, okay? If I said to you movie, what places make movies? You'd say what? Hollywood, LA, movie, the movie center. If I said education in America, what city would you say education? You'd say Boston, Harvard, MIT, Gordon College, Boston area. Okay? Education. There's like 48 colleges here. You've got Brandeis, you've got Tufts University, you've got all these, as well as Harvard. And Harvard and MIT, Gordon College being outside. It's one of the good things for Gordon College. Alexandria was one of the educational centers. They're going to have one of the biggest libraries in the world. They're going to gather books from all over the world in Alexandria. It's going to be a phenomenal library, the Library of Congress of the ancient world. There was no other place like it. It was a center for education, okay, built about 200 BC. Now, what's important for us is, as far as Israel, let's just take a step back and look at this. Areas of cultural interface then between Judaism and Greek culture. Judaism and Greek culture have to face each other now. And so what you've got is basically different areas that when we talk about culture, what are the different aspects of culture? One of those areas is going to be, for the Jews in particular, it's a big one, it's called religion. And so religion, the Jewish people, you know, they're of the circumcision, they do circumcision. The Jewish people eat kosher, they eat certain foods, they don't eat other foods. They do certain things around things that are unclean and other things that are clean and things. So the Jews have their very ethnic markers. They have their own Jewish markers that mark them as being Jewish. The Greeks, and they worship Jehovah. They worship one God. They worship one God, Jehovah or Yahweh. And Yahweh, Jehovah, the Lord, God. The Greeks, on the other hand, the Greeks will be, you know, Zeus and multiple gods and the gods fighting each other and duking it out and stuff. So the Greeks will have many gods, and they'll have regional gods, city gods, and big gods and stuff. And the Greeks and Jews will have priests, and the priests will be part of the religion, sacrificial system, temples and temple states and city states with temples in them. And so you'll have the temples and the priesthood and all this stuff around the religion, supporting the religion of these various areas. In the time of the New Testament, you're going to see emperor worship come in, where there'll be Roman temples to the emperor in various towns like Ephesus and other places. So religion will play a big factor, especially in the ancient world. Now, of course, in modern culture, everybody tries to put religion down and to silence religion and try to export religion from our culture and things. But nevertheless, it is a huge part of our culture. And usually in our culture usually in derogatory terms. If somebody says they're an evangelical, that's, you know, thumbs down in our culture. You aren't allowed to pray in school much anymore. The Ten Commandments taken out of schools, prayers, young girls suing because there's a prayer on the wall that they don't like because they're an atheist. And so there's been a real attempt in American culture to silence and to have religion. In other words, you can almost have overt sexual relations in public, but yet religion is supposed to be private. Religion has been now put into the bedroom while all sorts of promiscuity has been pulled out of the bedroom. And that's kind of where American culture is, kind of an interesting reversal there, I think. Of course, I'm being sarcastic, and you know irony, sarcasm. You got to be aware of that. I'm overstating things, using hyperbole, but that there's been a real effort to delete religion from American culture and stuff by secularists. So religion, big part back then. Military, you've got generals, you've got armies. In the New Testament, we're going to see guys called centurions. Centurions will be over the legions in Rome, and you'll have the Roman legions in there. I think in Jerusalem, there's a block that's got an X on it from the Roman 10th Legion that was stationed in Jerusalem. And they'll have centurions that are over 100 guys. Jesus will run into a centurion who will ask him to help his servant and things. So it's, you know, we'll have this whole military construction where the armies will be infiltrating. We'll have Greek armies, Roman armies, and stuff at various times in Palestine. So the military. Then these generals will also retire. And when these military leaders retire, they will get certain benefits and things. And so you'll see military people in Corinth. You'll see military people in Philippi and various things. Political. You'll have the king or emperor. And so there'll be these political structures. You'll have kings and emperors and governors and senators in Rome. And so you'll have this political structure that will also be part of the culture, as well as the courts. And the courts will do various things. And we'll see Paul going into the Roman court and having to defend himself before Agrippa and various people, Felix, Festus, and Agrippa in Israel. And so there are kings, there's governors, provincial rulers. There'll be provincial rulers, and then there'll be these larger senators, things like that. So there's a whole political structure from the emperor on down. And then as well as in the culture, there'll be slaves. There'll be slaves and freemen, huge amount of slavery, things like that. So not racial slavery like we have, but people enslaved. Some of the slaves will have good times. Some of them will have bad times. They go into the mines. It'll be really wicked slavery. Some of them were slaves were to the higher up people. Slaves were actually able to buy their own freedom and things. So there was quite a bit of variety in the levels of slavery and things like that. But you'll have slaves, you'll have free people, various levels of stratas of society built off the political. Economic, and that's actually taxes. Rome, all the empires, what do they want? They want your tax money. Kind of doesn't change until this day. What does the government want for you? They want to provide all these wonderful services for you. Rome will want to provide peace and harmony for their whole universe. And what is it? They want your money. Okay, they want your money, your taxes. And so that's what the name of the game is. And even till this day, and as I look at you folks, I will say $15 trillion going on $16 trillion you and your grandchildren will be paying for the rest of your life due to the wonderful benevolences of our government. Okay. Now, I'm sorry you can hear the sarcasm in my voice. That's a bunch of baloney. Government likes power, and therefore it does it through money and dominating the people in that way. So be careful with that stuff. You got merchants, traders. Traders will basically be connecting then across the empire, people with commerce and things going back and forth. Egypt will send boats to Rome with food and things. Rome will send commercial goods all over the ancient world. And the ancient world will send goods to Rome and back and forth. That's part of the benefit of the empire is the economic prosperity. Peace and prosperity brought about as a result of the empire. So those things are involved in the culture. Now the problem is then, how do the Jews react to Hellenism? What is the Jewish reaction to Hellenism when Hellenism takes over? And I want to just kind of do a rah-wah here as a kind of an acrostic. First of all, some of the Jews, when the Hellenism comes on, they will basically say, we don't want any of the Hellenism. And so they'll basically call for reform in terms of these will be the Pharisees. The Pharisees will pull back and say, no, we don't want Greek culture. We're Jews, and therefore we don't want it. And they will separate. So basically the Jews will separate themselves from Hellenistic culture. These are the Pharisees. They're more conservative. They're more conservative. And they want to conserve their own traditions. Does that sound familiar? Tradition. Okay, Fiddler on the Roof. They want to preserve their traditions, and therefore they want to reject Hellenism because Hellenism they see as compromising their religion. So the Pharisees were strict. They wanted to separate to preserve their ideology of Judaism. And so that was the Pharisaic reaction. Hellenism is coming in. The Pharisees say, no, we want to preserve ourselves. We're going to separate. We're going to keep our traditions. We're going to keep. So the Pharisees will reform themselves and say, no, we don't want to be part of it. The Sadducees, on the other hand, are sad, you see. The Sadducees will say, no, Hellenism is coming in. We need to assimilate with them. If you want to beat somebody, you assimilate and become part of them. So we want to become part of this Hellenistic culture. So the Sadducees were much more willing to give in. Some of them would, go out in the gymnasiums and wrestle. Now, what was the problem with wrestling in the gymnasiums of those days? In those days, the guys wrestled in the nude, okay? Now, the problem is you're a Jew. It's clear you've been circumcised. And so some of the Jews actually would try to have operations to reverse the process of circumcision and so that they could wrestle against the Greeks and look like the Greeks. Okay, so the Sadducees were also wealthy. These are a lot of your upper crusted people. We want to assimilate with the Greeks. And so a lot of the Sadducees were wealthy, whereas a lot of the Pharisees were actually on the poorer side. They were Jewish people that wanted to hold on to their culture very tightly, whereas the Sadducees integrated and became some of the political leaders and also wealthy. So they're going to be assimilating. And you can see then why there's a conflict between the Sadducees and Pharisees. Two different ways of reacting against Hellenism. One against Hellenism, the other accepting of Hellenism. And that, by the way, we have that same kind of cultural reaction even today in terms of how do Christians respond to secularism? Some people will embrace, as Christians, will almost embrace and see how close they can get to secularism so that they can be cool and things in various ways with the current culture. Others will pull back and say, no, we don't want part of secularism. We want to keep our traditions. And so you get the same type of thing with the conservatives and assimilators even till this day, compromising even till this day. Now, here's another group that's not really mentioned much in the New Testament. Some people think John the Baptist may be one of these. Basically, this one, when Hellenism comes out with this group says, we want to separate so much so that we're going to withdraw from culture. We're going to withdraw from culture, and these people then become monks, basically, out in the desert, and these are what's called the Dead Sea Scroll community. The Dead Sea Scroll says, we don't want to assimilate with Hellenistic culture, and we don't want to live within them and try to keep our traditions in the midst of it. The Essenes or the Dead Sea Scroll people, they thought the Pharisees were too loose. And so they looked down on the Pharisees, saying they were giving in to things. So these people will go off and form their own community down by the Dead Sea. And so you see then, and what did they do? They went down to the Dead Sea and they copied Scripture. They copied Scripture. They copied Scripture. Put them in jars, put them in these caves. And all of a sudden, in 1948, a little boy throws a rock in there. Arab kid goes in and he brings out the Dead Sea Scrolls, okay? After 2,000 years being in there, it's absolutely incredible. One of the greatest finds of the 20th century, found by a Bedouin boy in 1948, the Dead Sea Scrolls, which are, now you can read them in English translation. We've got a friend, Dr. Marty Abig, who's worked very big in the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of the greatest finds of the 20th century, the Dead Sea Scrolls, largely as a result of this community that said, Essenes said, Hellenism's coming out, we're going to withdraw to the into the desert and be our own group. And then they looked apocalyptically to the future when some great, you know, Davidic king would come and make things right. And so they basically withdrew from the culture and then looked to the future, when the future would be the apocalypse would come and the end of the world would come, and then they would be justified and the evil world would be destroyed. Kind of the chaos of the apocalypse now kind of thing with the Essenes. They looked to the future for the saving of that. And then here's another approach. Hellenism tries to come in. The Pharisees say, no, we're going to keep our traditions, thank you. We don't want your stuff. The Sadducees say, oh yeah, let's integrate with them. Let's be part of the Greeks and stuff. The Essenes say, no, no, we're going to go off and be our own little community. The Zealots said, we're going to attack Hellenism. We're going to attack Hellenism. We're going to kill the Greeks. We're going to kill Greek culture and stuff. So the Zealots then would be ones. These are the Zealots. The Zealots would actually attack, get physical, and go after this pagan culture that was coming in. They would actually defend their religion, their culture with a sword. Paul, many take Paul as being a zealot. Paul was going out killing Christians because he thought, hey, this is a transgressing Judaism and things, and these people are wicked because of what they're doing and violating Judaism, and therefore he would go out after the zealots. Paul was a Pharisee of the Pharisee. We know that from Philippians. He was a Pharisee of Pharisee, but he seemed to have zealot tendencies, as Dr. David Matthewson would say. So these are four responses in Judaism to Hellenism. Hellenism with Greeks, with Alexander taking over the world, is coming into Judaism, and Judaism responds in these four ways, okay? Pharisees, Sadducees, Essenes, and Zealots. Now, let's talk some more about Hellenism. Hellenism had a thing called allegorism. What is allegorism? This is a method of interpretation when you interpret the Bible in a certain way. Now, many of us will interpret the Bible as literally as we possibly can. It depends on the genre. But allegorism says, the book says this, but it really means something else. And so they turn these stories into allegories. And largely the Greeks used allegories because they didn't like the god Zeus beating up on other gods. And anyways, and they had all these god fights and stuff. And some of the Greeks said, that's really kind of backward that these gods are fighting among each other all the time. So what they would do is they'd take the fightings of the gods or whatever and turn them into allegories about various concepts or something. So allegory was to take something and turn it into an allegory, kind of like an allegory would be Pilgrim's Progress, where you've got Pilgrim meeting these various people who are personifications of various attributes and things. And so Pilgrim's Progress or the Narnia series by C.S. Lewis would be more allegorical ways of understanding them, because basically hermeneutics. Now, what is hermeneutics? This is an important concept. The concept of hermeneutics is how you interpret literature. How you interpret, what methodology do you use to interpret? Do you use the allegorical? If you see something you don't like, do you turn it into something else that you make it into a story about something else? Hermeneutics is the study of interpretation, how you interpret. So we have, for example, at Gordon College, we have a whole course. If you want to be a biblical studies major, which is the best, we have a whole course on hermeneutics, how you interpret scripture. And it differs. You interpret poetry different than you interpret narrative, historical narrative. You interpret a parable different than you interpret a historical text like the book of Acts. You interpret the book of Revelation. Well, actually, Revelation is really hard to interpret. Apocalyptic literature is really hard to interpret. How do you interpret the symbols of the book of Revelation? Those are all hermeneutics. How do you interpret the different genres of scripture? Anthropomorphism. What is anthropomorphism? The Greeks and early Christians, to be honest, and also the Jews, felt anthropomorphisms were offensive. Now, what are anthropomorphism? Anthropo means like anthropology. Anthropology means man or humankind. Humankind. Morphism is like morph, you know, when you say somebody morphs into something, it's changing form. So anthropomorphism is when you take the form of God and put it in human terms. You morph God into human terms. So it says, the eyes of the Lord run to and fro. Does God have eyes like we do? Does God have eyes like we do? I can just see in this room. I can't see what's outside this room. Can God's eyes, are God's eyes like our eyes? But yet it says, the Lord's eyes run to and fro. The hand of the Lord, the mighty hand, an outstretched arm and a mighty hand, okay? God said, have hand. The feet of God are talked about. Okay, the feet of God are talked about. Okay, in what sense does God have feet? Does he use feet to walk? I mean, what are his hands used? Does he actually use his hands to accomplish things? These are human attributes, human physical attributes, hands, fingers, eyes, nose, mouth, ears, hair, are described, head, as being described on God. And that was offensive to the Greeks because of the split that they had between that which is physical. There was a kind of a dualism that said that which is physical is bad and that which is spiritual is good. And this dualism that took place later on in Gnosticism, and I don't want to read that back in, but largely Docetism and Gnosticism later were extreme forms of this, but basically as dualism, the spiritual world was good and the physical was bad. So therefore, whenever God was described in physical terms, they found that offensive. And so what they used then, they used allegorism as a way of getting rid of the physical features of the gods and described them more in terms of ideals, kind of like Platonic ideals, Platonism, playing in the back, the forms, from the Republic, Book 7 and other places, the forms, these ideals that were held up. Now, another feature of Hellenism was this unified Greek language, this Koine, as they call it, Greek language, the common Koine. Here's how you spell Koine. Koine, K-O-I-N-E, Koine Greek, was common Greek. It was like what I call street Greek, and it was from 300 B.C. to 300 A.D., now, here's the problem. They're in Alexandria, okay, Egypt, in Alexandria in Egypt. They're wanting to collect all the books of the world. One of the most famous books of the world is the Hebrew Scriptures, the Torah, the Law, the Prophets, and the Writings, okay, Tanakh, okay, the Law, the Prophets, and the Writing, the three sections of the Jewish Old Testament, okay, the Torah being the Law, okay, the instructions. So what they did was they commissioned, Ptolemy commissioned in Egypt, Ptolemy commissioned in Egypt, he said, you know, we need a copy of the Jewish scripture, but nobody here can really read Hebrew. And so what happened was they said, we've got to get it translated from Hebrew into Greek. We've got to get it translated from Hebrew into Greek. So what happened was they translated it from Hebrew into Greek, and it's called the Septuagint. The Septuagint, or the Septuagint, it's pronounced various ways by various people, I've heard, but the Septuagint, or the Septuagint, okay? And it's abbreviated like this, LXX. Now, do you notice LXX is what? X and X is the Roman numeral for 10 and 10, and then L is 50, so this is 70, 70. Septa means 7. Hex, well, penta means 5. Hex means 6, hexagon. An octagon is 8, and a septagon is 7. Septa. So septa means 70. So 70. Now somebody asked me in class, what does the 70 stand for? Well, rumor has it that when Ptolemy hired these guys, he hired 70 guys for 70 days, and these 70 guys for 70 days translated the whole Old Testament. Now I just want to tell you, I've been a translator, and when this is in the 2000s, no 70 translators can translate the whole Old Testament in 70 days. That's absolutely absurd. Okay, so that rumor of 70 translators in 70 days translating the whole Old Testament, that's crazy. But my guess is they got a good start on it. You get 70 guys, you get 70 translators, they can do a lot of work and things. But they're translating from Hebrew into Greek. Okay, Hebrew to Greek. This gives us then, around 250 to 150 B.C., this gives us the Septuagint translation. This is about 150, 200 years, let's just say 200 years before Christ. You've got a Greek Bible. You've got a Greek Bible. What is the importance of this Septuagint? This is really important. The Septuagint basically goes, once you've got the Bible in Greek, oh, let's just take the Hebrew Bible. You've got a Hebrew Bible in Jerusalem, the Tanakh, okay? The law, the prophets, and the writings. You've got a Bible in Jerusalem in Hebrew. Who can read that book? If you take that book to Egypt, can they read it? And the answer is no, they don't read Hebrew. If you take it up to Turkey, can they read it? No, they don't. Take it over to Greece, they can't read it. You take it over to Mesopotamia, they can't read it. It can be read in Israel because of the Hebrew language barrier. Now, Ptolemy gets it translated, the Hebrew Bible, into Greek. Now you take the Greek Bible. Can the Greek Bible go down to Egypt? Can people in Egypt read it? Yes, they can. Can people in Greece read it? Yes, they can. Can people in Turkey read it because it's in Greek? Yes, they can. Mesopotamia, can they read it? Yes, they can. You take it all the way to Rome. Can Romans read it? Yes, they can. So now, all of a sudden, the Bible, the Old Testament, is allowed to spread throughout the whole world, and people can read it now. This is incredible. By the way, does this set up now, people, when they read the Old Testament all over the world, are they going to be aware that the Old Testament tells them that there is a coming Messiah who's going to be the son of David, who's going to rule? So now, all of a sudden, the world can know the Old Testament stories that set up for Jesus Christ coming 150, 200 years later. So the Septuagint was a wonderful thing to spread, allow Judaism to be spread all over so people understood things so that they could so that the gospel could spread. Because now wherever Paul would go, he'd go into the synagogues, they would have Greek Bibles that the people there could read and things, and so therefore the gospel could spread on the back of the Septuagint. It was really an incredible thing. So the Septuagint is incredible. By the way, when Paul and others in the New Testament quote, a lot of times they'll quote out of the Septuagint. So when they do quotes, they won't be quoting from the Hebrew text, they'll be quoting from the Septuagint Greek text. So that was done under the Ptolemies around 200 when the Ptolemies were good friends with the Jews. Ptolemies were tolerant. Ptolemies were tolerant. The Seleucids were not tolerant. Egypt translated the Septuagint and they were tolerant to the Jews. They ruled from about 300 to 200. Around 198, the Seleucids from Syria went down into Israel and conquered Israel. Okay, so the Seleucids, around 200, come down into Israel, and they are not tolerant of Israel. And so there's going to be some real conflicts now. The Syrians are going to try to force the Jews to become Hellenists, okay, to become Greek. So the Syrians are going to force their way down under Seleucus' rule and try to force the Jews. When you force one culture to become another culture, it doesn't work. There's rough edges. There's going to be huge clashes. And that's exactly what happens. Antiochus III took over. Antiochus III, or the Great, took over, and he's the one that conquered Israel away from the hands of the Ptolemies. The Ptolemies were tolerant. Egypt is rather provincial, to be honest with you, in many generations. Egypt is kind of to themselves. They don't want to conquer the world. Egypt wants to be just left alone, basically. So the Syrians came down, took Israel in the Battle of Panion in 198 B.C., Palestine gets taken away from the Ptolemies, who were good to the Jews. Romans are starting to enter the picture. The Romans are starting to flex their muscle. What does Rome want? Rome wants from Egypt, they want food. What do they want from Palestine and Syria, particularly Syria? They want money. They want taxes. And so Roman rule will start to be pushing out here, wanting money. Now, where are the Syrians going to get money for Rome? The Syrians really can't fight Rome. The Syrians aren't strong enough. So they need money to pay the taxes to Rome. So they're not going to take it from their own people very much. They're going to want to take it from the Jews. You conquer a group of people and you take all their wealth and then give it to the Romans. And so that's basically what's going to be happening here. Roman taxing is putting pressure on Syria. And so they're going to go after Israel. Now, this guy, Antiochus IV, is an incredibly evil person. Antiochus IV is going to be, in the book of Daniel, chapter 11, and other places, he is going to be a foreshadow or an adumbration of the Antichrist. This guy, when you read about the Antichrist, there will be little shadowings that go back to this guy as very much anti-God. His Antiochus IV, he's the son of Antiochus III, as you'd expect. He takes over about 175, he rolls down to 163. Okay? He calls himself Epiphanes, Antiochus Epiphanes, Antiochus the Illustrious. The people misnamed him, in kind of a play on words, Epimenes, which means Antiochus the Madman. And so there was a real clash. He was wanting to see himself as the illustrious, and the people saw him as a madman. And what did he do? He tried to forcibly Hellenize the Greeks, or the Jews, I'm sorry. He tried to forcibly Hellenize the Jews. And what he did was he forced Greek deities to be set up in the temple area. Now, what does that do to the Jews? The Jews have one God, Jehovah. Now he's setting up pagan deities in the Temple Mount. The Jews just totally felt violated by that, pagan deities in the Temple Mount. He required that people not circumcise their children. And so now a mother of twins has twin boys. She's told by God that those boys need to be circumcised on the eighth day, as it says in the Old Testament, circumcised on the eighth day. The woman has a choice. Does she obey God or does she obey Antiochus? Antiochus Epiphanes says, no circumcision. She instead follows God. She circumcises her boys. You know what Antiochus does? He ties the two baby boys around her neck and throws her off a cliff. And all the two babies and the mother are killed. Okay? Antiochus the madman. This guy is forcibly trying to force the Jews into Hellenism. It was really ugly and wicked. He offers pigs on the altar. If you know anything about Jewish backgrounds, you know they don't eat ham. They don't eat pork. Okay, pork, pig was considered unclean. So a Jewish person does not eat pork. It's considered unclean, and therefore this was not kosher. It didn't have K on the hand, okay? The pigs were offered on the altars that totally violated the altar, which was to be made to sacrifices to God, now becomes a place where pigs, that which is unclean, totally defiling the altar, defiling the whole thing because of the pigs and things. The scriptures, the Syrians realized the importance of the book, and the Syrians would burn the scriptures and stuff whenever they found them. So the Syrians were very much anti-Jewish. The Jews have faced this kind of persecution for thousands of years. Hitler's Germany was just one. Esther faced it back in her day. And now Antiochus Epiphanes is doing something similar. However, Antiochus Epiphanes, pushing down from Damascus and Syria, when he runs across certain Jews, he's going to have some problems because there's going to be certain Jews that aren't going to take it. They're going to fight back. Now, you've got some Jews who set up like this. Onias wanted to be high priest. And so now you've got these Syrians pushing down. So Onias tries to buy the high priesthood for money. So now you've got the high priesthood, rather than coming down from the line of Aaron and Zadok and being high priest, now the high priesthood is up to the highest bidder. Onias spends money on it. Jason gets a gym built and adopts Hellenism. And so Jason, do you even see the name Jason, is a very non-Jewish name. And so therefore, this guy takes over the high priesthood. Finally, Menelaus, this guy is a louse, basically he's from the tribe of Benjamin. And he takes over and uses the temple treasure. He takes the temple treasure of Jewish temple treasure and pays it to the Syrians so that he can be high priest. He's of the tribe of Benjamin. In order to be a priest, you had to be of what tribe? The tribe of Levi, and a descendant of Aaron somehow. He is of the tribe of Benjamin. It's not even the right tribe. And yet he takes over the high priesthood. So the high priesthood now is violated. And the Jewish people come to offer their sacrifices. They got this weirdo guy from Benjamin who's high priest now. It totally violates the Jewish culture. So that there's all this really anti-Jewish trying to destroy the Jewish culture and inculcate them with and basically big brother eyes brainwash them into Hellenism. Well, the Jews are going to react strongly against that. He even sets up in the altar area in the Temple Mount, he sets up an image of himself. And that's called the Abomination of Desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. Several hundred years, over 250 years before this time, 350 years actually, Daniel is going to talk about the Abomination of Desolation. By the way, Jesus will also refer to the Abomination of Desolation, spoken of by Daniel the prophet. And this Abomination of Desolation is done by Antiochus Epiphanes. He sets up, apparently, an altar with an image of himself and forces people to worship him or something like that. So he sets up and it requires people to worship him. And that imagery then is said what will happen in the end times, that there'll be one, the Antichrist will come and demand worship of all people. And so here we got with Antiochus, as you have Jesus, Cyrus, as you have Cyrus being a kind of foreshadowing of Jesus Christ, of the Messiah, Cyrus being called the Messiah and Jesus fulfilling that. Here you've got Antiochus Epiphanes being the forerunner of the Antichrist with the abomination of desolation. And so you've got both these people echoing into themselves into the New Testament. And so this abomination of desolation, desecrating the Temple Mount that was supposed to be for Jehovah, God Almighty, now desecrated with the image of this evil man and people made to worship. Who steps in? The Big Macs at this point. And this is the book of Maccabees. This is the book of Maccabees about 167 B.C. Book of Maccabees about 167 B.C. I'm not big on the date and stuff, but I'm just trying to give you a fix of where it is. The Ptolemies are off at 200. The Ptolemies are defeated. And now 167, the Maccabees. Now what happens with the Maccabees? These are the Big Macs. I call them the Big Macs, okay? The Big Macs. First of all, there's a father, Mattathias. Mattathias is the father. He's an old man. The Syrian legate comes out to his town, Modin, and basically says, hey, Mattathias, I want you to offer this thing that's unclean. I don't know if it was a pig or whatever. I want you to offer this thing that's unclean on the altar. You're the high priest, you're the priest in the area. And so therefore, offer this on the altar, and then we're cool with you. We won't mess with you. You've adopted Greek culture. We're cool. You're cool. Just offer this thing that's unclean on the altar. Mattathias is like, hey, I'm an old man. I've never offered anything unclean. I'm not going to do this, man. Well, this kid looks at Mattathias and says, hey, Mattathias, you're an old man. You get killed. You've lived your whole life. This is no good. I'm a young kid. I got my whole life before me. So this young kid takes that which is unclean, goes up, and he's going to offer it on the altar. Mattathias, the old man, grabs the young kid who's Jewish and kills him on the spot before he can offer that on there. So Mattathias then revolts against the Syrian legate, but Mattathias, the old man, well, he gets killed fairly quickly. He's got five sons. And his five sons are called the Big Macs. And this is the Maccabees. His five sons, Mattathias, the priest's sons, then revolt against the Syrians. These five boys then put together basically a guerrilla warfare, man, and they go after the Syrians who are trying to force them into Hellenism. The first one is really an important guy. He's probably the most important. He's Judas Maccabeus. Judas Maccabeus, he is called the Maccabee. Maccabee means hammer. This guy was a warrior. Judas was a warrior. They called him the hammer because he hammered stuff, okay? And he lives for about 6 years. He's going to get killed, but he's a warrior. He leads the Maccabean revolt. This Judas Maccabeus is the one who leads the revolt against the Syrian Antiochus Epiphanes and his generals, mostly his generals, Lysias, Gorgias, and others and stuff. Judas Maccabee attacks, goes up to Jerusalem, and actually takes Jerusalem. He takes Jerusalem, and he purifies the temple. He takes it, throws down all the defiling images of Antiochus and all these wicked things. He takes it all out, they purify it, and then, by the way, they have light. They were only supposed to have like 7 days of light with this olive oil, and rumor has it that God multiplied the oil to make it last an eighth day, which is really kind of interesting, because this purifying of the temple and the multiplying of oil for the lights then becomes what's known as the Feast of Lights. The Jews to this day celebrate the Maccabean purification of the temple in 167 BC is celebrated to this day everywhere around the world by Jews. It's called the Feast of Lights in the New Testament. Actually, Jesus celebrates this purifying of the temple. Today, you guys know it as Hanukkah. You say, Happy Hanukkah. When does that happen? Around our Christmas time in December. That Feast of Hanukkah, Happy Hanukkah, was started by Judas Maccabeus when he purified the temple, and there was the multiplication, and the Feast of Lights was started, and the Jews celebrate Hanukkah till this day. So Judas Maccabeus was quite a guy. He's definitely a general, a leader, and just actually did kind of tremendous things. Now, we've got to get down to some of his brothers. And he did Hanukkah. Okay, down to his brothers. The next brother that's actually, this guy's not really important, but it's always sad. When you read the book of Maccabees, basically what happened is the Syrians come down, not on camels. The Syrians come down out of Damascus on elephants, and they attack this place called Beit Zor. It's not important, but they're at Beit Zor. And Eliezer Maccabee looks up and he says, okay, they're on elephants. We're on the ground with our little sticks and stones and spears and stuff. They're at elephants with guys shooting bows and arrows down at us. We're dead meat. We got to take this guy out. So what he does is he says, I want to take out the biggest elephant, because who probably was riding on the biggest elephant? Yeah, the general, the biggest general would be over the biggest elephant. So Eliezer goes under the elephant. He gets himself under the elephant so they can't shoot him. And then he's under the elephant and he starts stabbing the elephant from underneath. He picks the biggest elephant and he goes after it. And he stabs from underneath. But the problem is, when you're stabbing the elephant from underneath, yes, indeed, he killed the elephant. But when the elephant is stabbed underneath and gets killed, the elephant falls flat, and Eliezer was crushed under the elephant. And so he's one of the great heroes of the Maccabean Revolt. I just like this guy because he has so much courage. He goes after the biggest elephant, single-handedly kills the elephant. But then, of course, he gives his life and the elephant crushes him. So that's Eliezer. I call him the Elephant Man. Sorry about that. But it's in the book of Maccabees. It's fairly interesting, those kind of stuff. Jonathan. Judas was the fighter. Judas was the fighter. Judas was the general. Judas is the one that went to war against the Syrians and the Seleucids and the Antiochus. Jonathan, he comes along later. Jonathan comes along after Judas has thrown off the Syrians and things. Jonathan plays more of a diplomatic role. And so you have this military punch and then followed up by a diplomat. And a diplomat, Jonathan, takes over, and the Syrians allow him to become high priest. So now Jonathan, a Maccabee, becomes the high priest. And he's in the priestly line. His father was a priest and stuff, so everything's cool. Jonathan then tries to do diplomacy and try to make good times with the Syrians. And by the way, the Syrians don't want to fight that much because, frankly, the Syrians got to pay the Romans taxes. And so rumor has it, the Syrians go down into Egypt and the Romans show up and drew a circle around him and said, hey, you got to pay us taxes. He says, I don't want to. They said, before you leave the circle, you're going to have to pay, agree to pay the taxes. So basically Jonathan then tries to make peace with them and becomes the high priest and tries to make diplomacy. Jonathan dies, however, and then Simon, the younger brother, takes over. Simon is the youngest one. Simon is the dynasty builder. Simon and his descendants build the dynasty out of the Maccabees that is called the Hasmonean dynasty. This word here, Hasmonean, Simon is the head of that Hasmonean dynasty. So Simon is one of the five Maccabees boys, and he then basically, through his descendant, father, son, father, son, father, son, produces a dynasty. That's a dynasty, father, son, father, son. His dynasty will go all the way down to the time of Herod, King Herod the Great. So we're going to look at next this Hasmonean dynasty. Okay, Simon and his descendants. These are all Maccabees then. These are Maccabees. So the Maccabees throw off the Syrians. Judas fights them. Jonathan diplomatizes them. And Simon then sets up a dynasty after that'll go on for over 100 years, about 100 years. Okay, so Simon then sets up the Hasmonean dynasty. And this is what the book of Maccabees is about. And if you're in this class, you realize we read the book of Maccabees and all the warfare going on there. It's a really interesting history. By the way, the book of Maccabees is not accepted in the Protestant canonical texts. It's considered the Apocrypha. The Roman Catholics accept it. The Protestants don't. Is it interesting history? Now, I would say that's not the Word of God, but is it interesting history and is it actually factually accurate and things? Yeah, it's good history. So I always think it's important to kind of read that history to get a background for the New Testament, because the Maccabees are going to play a background for this reaction against being forcibly reculturized in another culture. That same battle is going to take place against Rome. And actually, John, the book of Revelation, is going to have that same struggle between the tension between Roman culture dominating Christianity. And you're going to see different reactions to it then. Let's talk about the Hasmonean dynasty, okay? And then we'll try to get down to Herod. Here's some questions that come up. Who are the Hasmoneans? Okay, well, we said they're the descendants, the dynasty that comes out of Simon. So we know that one already. Where did the Pharisees and Sadducees come from? How did they actually, we talked about who the Pharisees were and their idealistic backgrounds, their ideals, but when did that actually happen? When did the Pharisees and Sadducees actually come into being, and why did the Pharisees and Sadducees hate each other besides the conflict of ideals? There's other historical roots as well. What was Herod the Great like? Herod the Great is going to be king at the time when Jesus is born. The Magi are going to go to Jesus, to Herod the Great, and the Magi are going to say, "Where is he that's been born king of the Jews?" Herod's going to say, "Wait a minute, I thought I was the king of the Jews." Now they say, "Where is he that's been born king of the Jews?" And then he's going to send out in Bethlehem of Judea. And so then he sends the Magi down to Bethlehem and things like that. But who was Herod the Great? What was he like? And why did everybody hate Herod the Great? Herod the Great had major problems. Why did the people hate him? Why did he kill the infants of Bethlehem? How does Rome get into the picture? We've got Greek culture now through the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, initially with the Ptolemies and then with the Seleucids. We've got Hellenism or Greek culture dominating Israel. How did Rome get into the picture in Israel? This all happens during these Hasmonean years. And then Jesus, was Jesus an Essene from Qumran or the Dead Sea Scrolls? What did the Essenes and what was Jesus' relationship and John the Baptist and other people make those kind of things? So let's look at the Hasmoneans first of all. The Hasmoneans, various forms. The first guy that comes in the Hasmoneans is a guy named John Hyrcanus. John Hyrcanus, you see his name here. He goes from about 135 to 104 B.C., and I'm going to use P-E-C-C to kind of do his thing. So he's about right just before 100 B.C., John Hyrcanus. He's the first of Simon's descendants. Simon was a Maccabee, one of the five Maccabees boys. One of his sons, John Hyrcanus, is now going to take over Israel. And this is when the parties get started in Israel. John Hyrcanus is one of the parties. The Pharisees are the strict ones who want to keep their traditions, the Hasidim. And the Sadducees become the Hellenists. These parties polarize under John Hyrcanus. The parties polarize. And this is when the Pharisees and Sadducees actually are born historically. Probably, you know, there's forerunners to this before this. But this is when they really become kind of like separate parties and things start to happen. John Hyrcanus expands the territory of Israel. So he's an expansionist. Okay, he takes over and he expands the boundaries of Israel. He's a strong king. Okay, this guy's a strong leader. Now, this is kind of ironic, isn't it? Remember the Jews were commanded not to be circumcised and they violated that? John Hyrcanus comes along and he says there's this group of people called the Idumeans. Now, who are the Idumeans? The Idumeans live, here's Israel, the Idumeans live to the south and to the east, the southeast of them. And the Idumeans are actually what in the Old Testament were called, there's some variations here and stuff, but Edomites. Edomites, do you notice the D and the M? The D and the M? Do you notice the D and the M? The Edomites and the Idumeans, pretty much the same thing, slight modifications and stuff. Who are the Edomites from? The Edomites were from Esau. Esau, remember Jacob and Esau? The Edomites were Esau's descendants. In the Old Testament, what did the Edomites do? Almost whenever you see an Edomite in the Old Testament, the Edomite's killing a Jew. Okay, the Edomites like to kill the Jews. The Jews sometimes kill back to Edomites, okay, David, others, stuff. So the Edomites and Jews went at it, okay? The Edomites kill a lot of Jews. Doeg, the Edomite, kills the priests of Nob and other things like that. John Hyrcanus takes over. He goes to the Edomites and says, "Hey, we're Jewish, we rule your territory, you guys all got to be circumcised." Now, being circumcised on the eighth day as a child is one thing, but when you go up to a 35-year-old man and said, "Hey, buddy, you got to be circumcised," I just want to tell you that's not a cool thing when you're 35 years old. And so now John Hyrcanus, you know, rather than leaving the cultures be by themselves, which was what he should have done, he forces them to become Jewish kind of thing with circumcision. Not totally Jewish, but to become circumcised. And so this is like kind of ironic. You know, the Jews were forced not to be circumcised and they resented it. Now he's forcing people to be circumcised when he's on top. And so you can see how things, when a person's on the bottom, they want all this freedom and stuff. When they get on the top, then they begin to dominate. And you begin to see this, how sometimes the people on the bottom, when they get on the top, are the worst tyrants you've got yet. And so therefore, Proverbs tells us, don't let a slave become a king because of this kind of turn things, and you'll get this, these dominant tyrants coming and taking over. Okay, and being really cruel because they don't understand things, and they were dominated. So John Hyrcanus is like that. John Hyrcanus makes a mistake with his kids. His kids are trained in Greek. He gets his kids trained in Greek culture. He wants his kids to be progressive. And so he has them trained in Greek culture. And as a result, he's going to lose his kids. Greek culture is going to dominate his kids rather than Judaism, the religion that he should have been training them in and stuff. So that's basically John Hyrcanus. P is for parties. E is for expansion, circumcision, and children. P-E-C-C. Aristobulus is going to be one of his kids. He's not going to be very important. The one that's going to be important is this guy, Alexander Janius. And this is the next big Hasmonean ruler. Coming down from Simon the Maccabee, John Hyrcanus. Aristobulus is nobody. And then Alexander Janius, the next big one. He's going to be F Cape. He goes from about 102 down to about 76 BC. So you're seeing we're getting down to 76 BC. We're getting closer and closer to New Testament times. Alexander Janius, he had some problems. He favored the Sadducees more. And so he's out at the Feast of Tabernacles, which is in the fall, usually in September or so. And he's at the Feast of Tabernacles. At the Feast of Tabernacles, the Jews come, and all the people come, and they're going to worship with a little branch, a palm branch, and they're also going to have a little citron in their hand, kind of like a, I don't know, little citron about this big in their hand. And they're going to come to worship. And Alexander Janius is going to go up, and he's going to take the holy water, and he's supposed to pour the holy water on the holy places. Okay? So he's supposed to pour the holy water on these holy places. Alexander Janius thinks this holy water stuff is, this is a bunch of baloney. And so Alexander Janius just pours it out on the ground and defiles the holy water. Well, now you've got all these really traditional people there with these citrons in their hand. And the king just pours the water, defiling the water out on the ground. What do all the people do? Well, the people in that part of the world like to throw things, don't they? Has anybody ever seen, President Bush got a shoe thrown at him and stuff? The people like to throw. They throw rocks. Actually, that's what they do most of the time. They throw rocks at people. And so anyways, these guys all got their citrons in their hand. The king defiles the water. All these people start pelting the king with these citrons. Okay? Now, by the way, the king gets pelted with citrons. He doesn't like this, okay? And so what's the king going to do? These people are poor people down here. He's the mighty big king. So what does he do? He gets the Pharisees and he crucifies about 800 Pharisees. He crucifies 800 Pharisees. Is that really wicked, bad thing? Is that a way to win friends and influence people? Crucifying Pharisees, he's of the Sadducee type. Do you see why there's going to be a conflict between Pharisees and Sadducees? It's not only through their ideals are different, but those ideals work out in this kind of a conflict with 800 Pharisees being crucified by Alexander Janius. So this guy's bad dude in terms of that stuff. He tries to assimilate all groups. He tries to assimilate all groups. And when you try to forcibly assimilate groups, does that work again, or are you making enemies and big problems? And so this forcible assimilation is a big problem. Ironically, the Pharisees who are getting beat up here, who do the Pharisees go to for help? The Pharisees go to the Syrians for help. Now, don't you find that ironic? The Syrians before were forcing the Jews to be Hellenized, and now the Pharisees, who are more traditional, are being beat up by the Sadducees. They go to the Syrians because the Pharisees are poor people, and the Sadducees are rich people, and basically they need help. They need military help, and so who do they go to but the Syrians? Their former enemies, they go back to their enemies now, and so there's this flip around where your enemy becomes your friend and fights this common foe, the Sadducees. This is kind of ironic. Alexander Janius, again, tries to expand territory, does so. And now let me just go. Okay, so that's Alexander Janius, kind of some brutal stuff there. When he passes off the scene, his wife is going to take over. And so this is different now, okay? We've had, John Hyrcanus, under Simon, Simon the Maccabees, John Hyrcanus, Aristobulus didn't count, then Alexander Janius, and now Alexander Janius' wife's going to take over, and her name is Salome Alexandra. Salome Alexandra, and she is Hameps, okay? She basically is going to do what? She's got two sons. She's a mother. She says, does a mother always try to split up things that are fair? You got two sons, you got two daughters, everything's got to be split up fair. And so the mother's got to, you know, split it down the middle, each get their thing. You say, what, a one kid weighs 240 pounds and the other daughter weighs 100 pounds. Question, it's got to be fair. You split it down the middle. Well, this kid needs more food. This kid doesn't need more food, less food and stuff. So fair doesn't always mean split in the middle. But, you know, so Salome Alexander, she's going to split things down the middle, man. So what she does is she says, okay, I got two sons. One's named Hyrcanus. This is easy to remember. Hyrcanus gets the high priesthood. So she says, okay, Hyrcanus, you get the high priesthood. It's nice they both start with the letter H. So Hyrcanus, you get the high priesthood. Aristobulus, her other son, you get the army. Aristobulus and army, they kind of go together. And so she splits it up basically between her two sons. Hyrcanus, the high priesthood. Aristobulus, the army. Now, what has she just done? She's, divided the power structure into two like that, and both her sons get half. But what's the problem now? You get one with the army and the other high priesthood. Question, as soon as she passes off the scene, what are those two brothers going to do? Do brothers fight? Yes. And so those two brothers are going to fight. One of them is going to have the army. The other one's going to have the high priesthood. And so probably the guy with the army is one of your favor. But anyway, so this becomes a problem now. And so she sets that up by the way she split things up. She married Aristobulus, and then she's married to Alexander Janius, so she married the brothers in a row, kind of down. We've seen that with Jesus. Does anybody remember with Jesus and the Sadducees? You know, there's a woman who is married to a man. Her husband dies. She has no children. Then she's married to the next brother, and to the next brother, next brother. Finally, all seven have her. In the resurrection, therefore, whose wife shall she be? Matthew chapter 22 or 3. Okay, whose wife shall she be in the resurrection? Here you see Salome Alexander did marry the one brother and then married the next brother on down, okay, Alexander. And so she married the two successively. She pushes education and tries to get the people educated. That's a good thing and things. So she links up with the Pharisees. She's more conservative than her husband was not. It was more linked with the Sadducees. She links more with the Pharisees. But then she splits with these her sons and stuff. The Sadducees under her are more abused, okay? So she links more with the Pharisees, so now the Sadducees come under hard times under her. Now, what happens next? We said she's going to pass off the scene, and now what are the brothers going to do? What do you figure, okay? Hyrcanus II, he takes the high priesthood. He's got the high priesthood. He takes the high priesthood. Aristobulus got the army. Aristobulus takes the army and they march then against the high priesthood of Hyrcanus II. And basically the Pharisees and Sadducees and Aristobulus march on Jerusalem. Aristobulus then takes over. Hyrcanus, he's got the high priesthood. He doesn't have the military wear to fight his brother. And so what happens is he goes to Aretas, who's kind of down with Idumea over in Edom, and these guys were called Nabataeans at the time. They were kind of traders who came in down the southern part of Israel. He goes to Aretas, the Nabataean, for help down south, and he tries to get military help from there. So what you've got is these two brothers duking it out. Aristobulus versus Hyrcanus. The army versus the high priesthood. The high priesthood doesn't have power, so what he does is grabs the Nabataeans and tries to get the Nabataeans to fight on his side, and they fight. Who steps in? Who doesn't want fighting? Who wants peace in the empire? The one that wants peace in the empire is Rome. Because Rome, when they have peace, they can collect taxes and everything goes well. When they've got two brothers duking it out, they can't get tax money out of them. What are you going to do? So what happens is Rome in 63 BC, and this is a big transition, the two brothers, Aristobulus and Hyrcanus, are duking it out. In 63, Rome steps in and says, back off, brothers. No more fighting. Each to your corner. You know, take a time out here. And basically, Rome in 63 BC steps in and takes over Palestine. Okay? So 63, Rome takes over. Guy named Pompey. Pompey comes in. general, walks into the Holy of Holies in the Temple Mount, looks around, apparently didn't see anything, says, hey, there's nothing in here, walks around the Holy of Holies and walks out. That's Pompey, 63 BC, goes into the Holy of Holies. Antipater's boys, who are Idumeans, Antipater, Idumean down south, his boys are trained in Rome. And so Antipater says, hey, these Jews are always fighting each other. Why don't you make one of my boys, king of the Jews? And so I realize we're Idumean, but hey, the Idumeans and Jews didn't get along too well anyways. But Antipater has an in with Rome. And so what he does is he makes a request to the Roman government. Now, the Roman government structure, we get various things, and I don't want to spend a lot of time on this and things, but the senatorial provinces, you've had Rome, the structure from Rome. You've got the emperor, at the top of the pile. You've got the Senate underneath, you know, or however the configuration there was back and forth, the emperor, the Senate, and then you've got these senatorial provinces. You've got the legions, the Roman legions, and the various generals in the Roman legions, the centurions, and then you've got common people, and you've got slaves in the empire. And so you've got the imperial provinces, you've got legions, army legions that answer to the emperor, and then you've got this kind of client state set up, okay? This client state set up where Israel would be a client state to Rome. So it'd be like a patron and a client, and Israel would be a client then that had to pay taxes. And what did they benefit? They benefited peace and harmony. Rome would make it so it's peace and harmony so they could trade and stuff. But what would they do? They had to pay taxes and had to be nice and not fight and stuff. And so basically you had this Rome and then these client states going down. Now, Herod. Herod was Antipater's son. And Herod then is put on by Rome, Herod the Great. This is Herod the Great, dies, as we said before, in 4 BC. Actually, Jesus was born about 5 BC. And this is Herod the Great. This is the one that's recorded in the Bible. This is the time, just around the time, just before this, you had Julius Caesar in what's called the First Triumvirate. Julius Caesar, do you remember Caesar gets it stuck and you got Atu Brute and all this kind of stuff, Brutus killing him and stuff. And so you've got Julius Caesar becoming the supreme leader. He is assassinated about 44 BC. This is just before the time of Herod the Great and Brutus and that kind of stuff. This is the first triumvirate with Julius Caesar. Herod, about 37 BC, Herod is made king of the Jews. And so Antipater makes a plea to Rome saying, hey, make one of my sons, you know, head of this provincial area. And so Rome says, okay, we'll take Herod and we'll make your son Herod king of the Jews. He's called Herod the Great. We're going to see why he's great and why he's not so great. But Herod was made king of the Jews. By the way, when he's made king of the Jews, can you see why Herod would get a little upset? The Magi come from the east following a star. They come to Jerusalem and they ask Herod, where is he who has been born king of the Jews? Was Herod born king of the Jews or was he made king of the Jews by Rome? And so now the Magi come and ask, where is he that's been born king of the Jews? Herod gets a little bit upset about that. I'm the king of the Jews, you know? So, if you can't be a Jew and you're an Idumean, you're of the stock of Edom, of Esau's descendants, Esau becomes Edomite, Edomite becomes Idumean, you're an Idumean, you're Herod. If you can't be a Jew, the next best thing you can do is marry a Jew. And so what he does is, Herod is kind of a fox, okay? Herod, what he does is he marries Mariamne. Mariamne is a Hasmonean. Now, what's a Hasmonean? A Hasmonean means she is of the line of Simon the Maccabee, John Hyrcanus, Alexander Janius, all the Maccabees down. The Maccabees were the leaders of Israel. Going back to the Maccabees, the Hasmoneans were the leaders of Israel. And so he marries this princess of the Jews that goes back to the Maccabees. Okay, so he's very smart. He marries Mariamne. Now, there's going to be some problems. There's a woman in Egypt at the time, and her name is called Cleopatra. Cleopatra is in Egypt, and Cleopatra hates Herod's guts. Is there anything worse than the scorn of a woman who's in power? She hates Herod's guts. So what she does is she says, okay, Herod, I don't like you, man. You're a jerk. Probably was. So she sends him on these all wild goose chases out in the desert. And she says, Herod, I want you to chase the Bedouin. Oh, there's some Bedouin out in Arabia. You got to go out in the desert and chase these guys out in the desert. And Herod says, what is this? I'm chasing guys in these Bedouin? These Bedouins are nobodies. They're riding camels out in the middle of the desert. I don't want to be doing that. I want to be sitting in my palace with my royal, you know, entourage around me and things. No. She says, you go out and chase these guys. So Herod is put on all these wild goose chases by Cleopatra. On one of the wild goose chases or whatever, Herod says to one of his guys, if I don't come back, you kill Mariamne, his wife. If I don't come back from this, exploit out to get these Bedouin, you kill my wife. Now, apparently, because the woman's Jewish and the guard was apparently Jewish, the guard told Mariamne that Herod said if he didn't come back, he's going to kill you. Does that make real good for a husband-wife relationship? The husband goes off to war. If he doesn't come back, the wife has been told that she's going to be killed. Needless to say, the relationship starts fracturing, and Herod ultimately ends up killing Mariamne. Okay? He ends up killing Mariamne, his wife. It was one of the only people he trusted. I saw a play in Jerusalem where Herod is running around like a crazy man. Herod was paranoid. Herod was paranoid. Well, actually, is it paranoid when people actually do want to kill you? Maybe that isn't paranoia. But he was running around like a crazy man saying, Mariamne, Mariamne, and he's the one who killed her. Mariamne, come back, come back. And he's the one who killed his wife. And so, anyways, Herod kills his own wife, the wife that he supposedly loved. He kills his own wife. And so this shows you the kind of guy he was. Cleopatra is married to Mark Antony. You got Mark Antony and Cleopatra. This is the second triumvirate. And then you've got Augustus coming out of this. Augustus Caesar calls himself Savior, and he is the good news, the announcement, basically in the book of Luke with Augustus Caesar is when Jesus is born. Augustus Caesar, and then Herod the Great is king, and Augustus is Caesar, and this is kind of the setting for the New Testament. One other thing I should say about Herod, and we'll, two other things I want to say about Herod. Herod was a major jerk, killed his wife, and I'm going to show you something else that did worse than that, or as bad as that. Herod was one of the great builders of the ancient world. Herod was an incredible builder. Herod, along the coastline of the Mediterranean, there was only one port at Joppa, really. Joppa, we call it Tel Aviv today. Just up the street, he says, I want to build my own harbor up at Caesarea. So he goes up the coast a ways from Joppa or Tel Aviv, and he builds a place called Caesarea Maritime on the Mediterranean Sea. But in order to do that, because the sand is going up and down, he takes these huge stones and he drops them into the ocean to form his own harbor. In other words, he makes a harbor out where there was no harbor before, just by dropping these huge, huge stones into the ocean and forming a harbor for him. Now, how do you connect rocks underwater? Well, normally, if you're above water, you use a thing called cement. Herod, and I think was known in Rome, figured out a way of congealing cement underwater. So Herod got underwater cement and developed and connected his rocks with underwater cement. By the way, those huge stones, and you can see on a satellite image, to this day, you can see the harbor that Herod built. It's absolutely incredible. By the way, who was imprisoned at Caesarea that Herod had originally built? Paul will spend a couple years, I think it is, at Caesarea as he's waiting trial in Jerusalem and then ultimately gets shipped to Rome. So Caesarea becomes a big thing on the coastline. Herod built that harbor and all sorts of stuff. Herod was a builder. Herod was an incredible builder. And by the way, talking about the temple. Herod extended the Temple Mount, took the small temple that was built in the time of Ezra and Nehemiah, and he remodeled it and made it into one of the seven wonders of the ancient world. A huge temple on a huge platform. And that platform, by the way, is still used by the Dome of the Rock and the Al-Aqsa Mosque. Even till this day, that platform of Herod is still in existence and still being used, people walking on that platform till this day. So Herod rebuilds the temple, and that's why Jesus said, destroy this temple in 3 days, and I'll raise it up in 3 days. And the people just freaked out. Herod took 46 years. How are you going to do this? By the way, to this day, and if you get my program, Get Lost in Jerusalem, you can go up to the Western Wall, or what they call the Wailing Wall. The Jews prefer the Western Wall now. It's the last part of the second temple that's left. And when you go up to the stones that you're going to see there, you see these huge stones. You can tell a Herodian stone just by the frame that it has around it. So I can walk up to that wall and I can pick out which stones Herod put there and which ones Herod didn't put there, because Herod's stones were so well crafted. They were so well crafted that you can't get a razor blade between the stones. They are so well fit together. Herod was an incredible builder, rebuilt the temple. It's that second temple that Jesus is going to come into. Jesus is going to walk into and throw out the money changers of Herod's temple. Now, the last one here that he built was Masada. He actually built some places over in Jordan and down by Bethlehem too, the Herodian down by Bethlehem and other places. Herod was paranoid, and he thought people were trying to kill him. The problem is, were people trying to kill him? Very likely they were. And so Herod was scared, so what he did was he went down to a place called Masada. And I just want to tell you the story of Masada, lest the story be lost. In America, we have a thing called the Alamo. And the Alamo will never happen again, like the last of the Alamo. And Alamo, like when their back was to the wall, the Alamo went down. Herod built Masada. Masada is a mesa that goes up from the Dead Sea. It's down by the Dead Sea, really hot down there. And it goes up about 1,200 feet, straight up, 1,200 feet. And there's, I don't know, 30, 40, 50 acres on the top of this mesa. Herod then, there's a snake path that goes up the front of it, and it's 1,200 feet up, and then there's this thing at the top. Herod carved out cisterns up on the top, and he had those cisterns full of water. So he filled, and I'm not talking just, 100 gallons, 200 gallons. These are tens of thousands of gallons of water he had put up there. He also put up storerooms, and he's got huge buildings of storerooms where he stored grains of wheat and barley. And so there was food and there was water. Hey, you got food and water. Can you live a long time with food and water provided? So what happened is Herod built Masada with palaces on the north end. Well, Herod dies, and the Jews, Jesus comes, and the temple is destroyed in 70 AD by the Romans. And the Jews at the time of the Romans, they destroyed Jerusalem, and some Jews then ran down to Masada, and these Jews climbed up on the top of Masada. I think there were about 900 Jews, climbed to the top of Masada, and they said, "We will not submit to Rome," thumbed their nose at Rome, "and we will not submit." They were at the top of Masada. The Romans come down to the Dead Sea and they say, "We're going to attack." And all of a sudden they look up and it's like, "Holy cow, this thing's 1,200 feet high, man. What are we going to do?" And the people up on the top got all the water they want to drink. The people at the bottom are next to the Dead Sea. What's the problem with the Dead Sea? Besides being 1,270 feet below sea level and being 33% salt, you drink that water, you're dead shortly. Okay? There's no water. You got to go back to En Gedi and other places to get the water. They don't have water. And so then basically the Jews are up on top laughing at them, saying, "Romans, the sun's going to cook you, man." And Josephus, the Jewish historian, narrates this. This is about 73 AD. About 73 AD. The Romans destroyed the temple in 70 AD. I'm going to want you to know that date. 70 AD, the temple is destroyed. This is about 3 years after that. You don't thumb your nose at Rome. Even if you're 900 people and you got all the water and food you want up at the top, you don't, it's 1,200 feet straight up, you don't thumb your nose at Rome. Rome sends an architect down there. The architect says, "Okay, we're going to have to take that mountain and we're going to have to take that mountain and push it up the side over here to make a ramp up to it so we can batter ram the walls down and we can get up there. We got to make this ramp. How are you going to make this ramp?" It's 1,200 feet straight up. The Romans start bushel after bushel after bushel of dirt after dirt after dirt, and they make a ramp up the back side of the Mount of Masada. They make a ramp up the low side of Masada, still like 800, 900 feet, straight up. They make it. They have to take down another mountain. They do it. They do it using Jews as slaves and other things like that, but then they do it. They put things up there so that they can hoist up a battering ram. And they hoist up a battering ram up and up and up after, I think some rumor has it that it took them like 3 years to build this ramp. They're out in the desert building this thing for 3 years. Other people say they did it quicker. But anyways, they're pulling the battering ram up here. The Jews then have fire here, and the Jews fire down on the battering ram, try to set it on fire. But they've got they've got iron on the front of it and stuff, and they bring it up, and they bring it up the wall, and they start banging on the wall, banging on the wall. And the Jews are up there realizing that the next day the Romans are going to break through. The next day the Romans are going to break through. They've got 900 people up there. They've been up there safe and things. The Romans couldn't get them, but the Romans are coming through. They're going to batter it down. Well, the next day comes. The Romans sat for the night. They come up the next day, and the battering ram goes, and they bash through the wall. But you know what? There was no noise up there that day. When the Romans walked in on the top of Masada, there was nobody to greet them there. There were 900 dead Jews. They had all killed themselves and committed suicide. 900 Jews dead on the top of Masada. And what do the Romans get out of that? 3 years of working in the hot desert. And what did they get? 900 dead Jews in the top of in the middle of a desert. That was Masada. The story of Masada. The Jews say, till this day, Masada will never happen again. And even today, sometimes for the Air Force, you can see the Air Force jet buzzing the top of Masada. Masada will never happen again. Masada was built by Herod the Great. Herod the Great was one of the great builders of all time. Absolutely incredible. Now, one more thing about Herod. Caesar said of Herod, "I'd rather be Herod's hus than his huios." I'd rather be Herod's hus than his huios. I'd rather be Herod's pig than his son. What did Herod do to his own sons? He was paranoid that somebody was going to try to kill him. Who would try to kill him? Usually it would be in-house type things. So what Herod did was, Herod ordered that his sons be killed. I remember when my son and I were walking down from Jerusalem. We came down, actually we drove down to Wadi Kilt and on down to New Testament Jerusalem. New Testament Jerusalem is separate from Old Testament Jerusalem, I don't know, a mile or so. And New Testament Jerusalem was covered over with all barbed wire and stuff. So my son and I climbed through the barbed wire, get through the barbed wire, and I had my son stand in a cistern, stand in a pool. Actually, it was a pool down at New Testament Jericho. And you know why I did that? Because Herod did what to his son in that pool? Herod sent his son down to the pool at Jericho and then told his guards to basically hold the kid underwater and drowned him in the pool. So basically, me being the nasty father that I am, I had my son get down in the pool. I snapped a picture. He didn't know what it was about, but I was kind of trying to re-dramatize that. There was no water for anywhere around there, but anyways, it was just something that we got back out through the barbed wire and took off and things. But Herod, I'd rather be Herod's pig. Herod protected the pigs out of respect to the Jews. He did not eat, you know, kill pigs and eat pigs and stuff like that. Out of respect to the Jews, he didn't kill pigs, but he killed his own sons because of his paranoia and things. This is Herod the Great. What is Herod the Great going to do in the New Testament? You guys have started on the book of Matthew. In the book of Matthew, chapter 2, wise men, infants, Egypt to Nazareth, what is Herod going to do? Herod is going to kill his own sons, and in Matthew chapter 2, he's going to kill the infants of Bethlehem who are under 2 years old and under. He's going to kill them. Was that a big thing for Herod? Herod killed his own wife, killed his own sons. To kill 12, probably 12 kids in the town of Bethlehem, it's a small town. To kill 12 babies under two, is that a big deal? It's so insignificant in terms of the nastiness of Herod, it's not even mentioned in the external history books. But that's how the New Testament starts. King, the mighty King Herod killing infants, and Jesus, God's son, spared the killing of Herod. And the King of the Jews is going to rule on the throne of David forever and ever. Well, we'll pick it up there next time. And thanks for the afternoon, and all the best.
This is Dr. Ted Hildebrandt in his New Testament History, Literature, and Theology course, taught at Gordon College in the spring of 2012. This is lecture number 2 on Alexander, Hellenism, and the Hasmoneans down to the time of Herod the Great.